Those of you who were here last Sunday know that I tried something called Talk Back. We're going to try that. We'll see how we do for time this morning. We're going to do it a little bit different. And that is up on a slide this morning. You've got, if you have questions or comments, you can text them to my cell phone. I am not going to stop along the way and read those. But as soon as the sermon is over and where you're singing a song, I'm going to have a glance over there and just take a few minutes afterward to respond to any questions or comments that you may have. I don't know about you, but one of the headlines that caught my eye this week, guess it helps if I turn it on, of course, was the headline, Donald Trump calls Pope Francis disgraceful for questioning his faith, or variations on that. The Pope made some controversial comments en route from Mexico, hours after he had prayed at the Mexico-U.S. border for migrants who died trying to reach the United States. And it was, I guess, of special interest because David Maria Bonilla, who we've supported in our church as missionaries, that's exactly where they are working on the border there in Nogales, Mexico. And when asked about Trump's promise to build a wall, Francis simply responded to that saying, "A person who thinks only about building walls, wherever they may be, and not building bridges, is not Christian." Donald Trump, of course, responded forcefully to the Pope's comments by saying, "A religious leader questioning a person's faith is disgraceful, and that no leader, especially a religious leader, has a right to question another man's religion or faith." Well, it is not my intention this morning to give a political commentary on this news item. I simply want to point out how certain opinions and practices often do become litmus tests of whether or not someone is behaving according to their beliefs. In this case, is someone behaving like a Christian or not? Is that reflected? For example, a Pontius Puddle cartoon. You've heard the saying, there are no atheists in foxholes, right? You know, if they say they're an atheist, suddenly in that situation they start praying, you're like, you're not a real atheist. Okay, and then, of course, there's also an alternative, and there's few Christians behind the steering wheel of a car, as he's saying, move it or die, bozo. Okay, so we would say that's not really very Christian behavior. Now, one of the hot cultural topics believers were wrestling with in Paul's day, kind of a litmus test one, was whether that he describes in 1 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 1, as food sacrificed to idols, and whether Christians could take and eat or not. And some of you, when I did a sermon earlier, may recall I used the analogy of in Halloween of, is it okay to trick or treat or not? And the various Christian responses. Now, this particular issue was a complex issue. And we know that simply from the fact that Paul takes three chapters, 1 Corinthians chapter 8, 9, and 10, to respond to a variety of issues connected to this particular one. And today we want to look at his conclusions that he comes to in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 14 to the end of the chapter. So I invite you to turn there. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, beginning at verse 14. Therefore, my dear friends, and what is the therefore? He's just given them some history lessons about how Israel wasn't really following God and it got them into big trouble. Therefore, my dear friends, flee from idolatry. I speak to sensible people. Judge for yourselves what I say. Is not the cup of thanksgiving for which we give thanks a participation in the blood of Christ? And is not the bread that we break a participation in the body of Christ? Because there is one loaf. We who are many are one body, for we all partake of the one loaf. Consider the people of Israel. Do not those who eat the sacrifices participate in the altar? Do I mean then that food sacrificed to an idol is anything, or that an idol is anything? No, but the sacrifices of pagans are offered to demons, not to God, and I do not want you to be participants with demons. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons too. You cannot have a part in both the Lord's table and the table of demons. Are we trying to arouse the Lord's jealousy? Are we stronger than He? I have the right to do anything, you say. But not everything is beneficial. I have the right to do anything. But not everything is constructive. No one should seek their own good, but the good of others. Eat anything sold in the meat market without raising questions of conscience, for the earth is the Lord's and everything in it. If an unbeliever invites you to a meal and you want to go, eat whatever is put before you without raising questions of conscience. But if someone says to you, and this has been offered in sacrifice, then do not eat it, for both the sake of the one who told you and for the sake of conscience. I'm referring to the other person's conscience, not yours, for why is my freedom being judged by another's conscience? If I take part in the meal with thankfulness, why am I denounced because of something I thank God for? So whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do it all for the glory of God. Do not cause anyone to stumble, whether Jews, Greeks, or the church of God. Even as I try to please everyone in every way, for I am not seeking my own good, but the good of many, so that they may be saved. Follow my example as I follow the example of Christ. Food sacrificed to idols is still a pressing concern to some Christians in various African, Latin American, and Asian cultures. Related issues include whether or not to participate in various rites and rituals venerating one's ancestors, or how much one can incorporate forms of worship that they may have grown up in other religions, and now that they've become Christians. For example, I know some Muslim background believers, that is Muslims who've become Christians. You know, should I continue in the Islamic pattern of prayer? Because I should still be praying regularly as a Christian. I'm so used to, you know, using a prayer mat. Can I continue to do that, etc.? Yet I suspect for most of us, the issue that food sacrifice to idols will not rank among the top 10 or even top 100 moral dilemmas in your life. Am I right?
Yeah.
Okay. But I've compiled a list of a few items that I think might, which I hope will help us better understand why Paul takes 3 chapters to address a number of principles involved in deciding how much to embrace and how much to abstain from a variety of common practices in our culture. Commentator Kenneth Bailey describes Paul as providing a trilogy of responses to the issue of how much to identify with culture. How much are we influenced by it, and how much should we influence it? How much can we identify with it or not? And so he provides a basic framework that would go from, I've got on your left-hand side, like there's no limits. It's just like, go ahead, participate, okay? And then to the, you know, and on the middle of the road is, well, there's some limits, it depends. And we'll see, so we saw some of that in Paul's response. And then on the right-hand side, it's like strict limits. Never should you be doing this. And so if we looked at the issue, for example, of food offered to idols, you can see where Paul put. It's like, well, there's not just one answer, because it's different scenarios and situations in which you'll find yourself. If it's the marketplace, if it's dinner invitations. Oh, I see my temple worship got flipped over there, but you can see where that is. So basically, you know, on the one hand, full cultural association, you know, Jesus, the incarnation would be a model of when Paul says, become all things to all people. That is, in terms of being able to reach them, so that by all means I might save some, he will say, back in chapter 9. In the middle, some cultural association, some things to some people, in terms of association and participation. And then none, that is total abstinence, we would say. Nothing for anyone, no identification is possible. So I've compiled a little list here, and we'll see how you can do on the test. So, some of ours, okay? So I want you to put in your own mind, you know, participating in Halloween. Someone asks you that, and you put it in category, you know, yes, depends, or no way, Jose. With me? Okay. How about going to a movie theater? Some of you remember when that was taboo. Well, how about watching an R-rated movie? How about reading Harry Potter books? It's interested to Kill a Mockingbird. Of course, Harper Lee passed away this week. That used to be on the banned list in some areas. You can fill in other ones. How about believing God used evolution? Going out to the bar? How about physician-assisted suicide? Hot topic in our country at this time. How about participating in a public protest? I think, for example, on Burnaby Mountain with the pipeline. How about joining a yoga class? Or if yoga is not your thing, maybe a Masonic lodge. How about gambling? You may say, well, buying lottery tickets or going to a casino. I'll let you decide. Those are all a range of gambling. How about attending a gay wedding? You know, a friend, a relative, or family member maybe is getting married and has invited you to the wedding. Now, who thinks we all agree where each of these fit on the continuum? Now, you know why Paul spends 3 chapters on the hot button issue of his day. Let's explore the various responses and especially the principle Paul gives to the hot potato issue of his day. You know, in verse 14, he begins with a warning cry to flee from idolatry. If I can switch this. Yes, to flee from idolatry. And he had a particular one in mind, but I thought it would be helpful. You know, idolatry is really making a good thing often the ultimate thing. And if you want to read a good book on this, you think, well, we don't really have idolatry in our day. Read Timothy Keller's book, Counterfeit Gods. I think that's what it is. And I'll give you the summary if you don't want to read the whole book. He talks about cultural idols. Think about the military, technology, the economy. And somebody sent me a cartoon this week. I appreciate those. Calvin and Hobbes, he said, we seem to understand the value of oil, timber, minerals, and housing, but not the value of unspoiled beauty, wildlife, solitude, and spiritual renewal. I think there's some cultural idols deeply entrenched. Oh, that reminds me. I have a free book giveaway every once in a while, as you know. If you want more about that topic, I know Brian McLaren wrote a very interesting book a number of years ago, Everything Must Change. How would Jesus respond to the big global questions? So if you want a book review instead, the 2-page, you can pick up that instead. I was just given a bunch of books recently, and I thought I should pay it forward. There's also intellectual idols. We think, of course, of different ideologies, but sometimes I say some people believe, well, if they were just educated, people wouldn't do bad things. And I call that salvation by education. And it's not that education isn't good, but if you think, oh, that's just people need to know enough and then they'll do the right thing. Okay? And then there's also vocational idols. Profit in business is good. Businesses need profit to continue, but is it the ultimate thing? Sport is winning at all costs. It could be an art, self-expression, whatever that is for shocking factor. Those could be some of the idols. And Paul says that some of these we need to flee. So I think one of the questions that Paul really probes, if you look at the word participation, comes up again and again in the first one. I think what he gets at is there's this myth of neutrality. I think the Corinthians are thinking, it's just neutral ground. You know, they're going to participate in temple worship, involved in other kinds of religions or prayers or whatever that may be. And he'll say in verse 16, the cup of blessing or thanksgiving. That's the name that the Jews gave to the cup at the end of the meal because a prayer of thanks was given over it. You may have heard, blessed art thou, O Lord, who, and then bringeth forth food from the earth. The cup of thanksgiving here refers to Jesus' specific use of it at the Last Supper with his disciples, in which he identified himself and his body as the climax and fulfillment of the Passover meal. You see, originally an unblemished lamb's blood was the means of Israel's salvation, their deliverance out of slavery in Egypt. You can read about that in Exodus. But during the Last Supper, the Passover became transformed into what Christians celebrate as the Lord's Supper, or we call it communion, or the Eucharist, a thanksgiving to God, with the body and blood of Christ. Taking on the focus and function previously held by the Passover lamb. And Paul elsewhere will call Christ our Passover lamb. And so this is the background that he's talking about. And their regular participation in the Lord's Supper and communion becomes the focal point of Paul's reflection and practical advice in verses 16 to 22. This repeated use of the word participation, the Greek word is koinonia. That is shared, active and intimate involvement. It was used for the language of a close partnership or a close friendship. It is the living bond that unites Christians, wrote one writer, a fellowship in which we participate with the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. Our participation with Christ and the family of God makes certain other kinds of participation, Paul says, like participating in a worship, in pagan worship, that is not acceptable. You're arousing the jealousy of the Lord, okay? Because we are married to Him, and then you're participating in intimate fellowship to another being opposed to God? Like, that is not acceptable. It's totally incompatible. I want to come back to one of the questions earlier on your test quiz. What if I am invited to a same-sex wedding ceremony? Is going to the marriage ceremony no big deal, or is it a form of participation? Will not going cause such a rift in the relationship that I get cut off from any possible influence in the future, positive influence? Well, I think attendance in that kind of thing, setting, is a form of participation and often an implicit support of the marriage. You know, in the good old days, the support was made very explicit. In the part of the wedding ceremony, it was, should anyone present here know a reason why this couple should not be joined in holy matrimony, speak now or forever hold your peace. It's still implicit, and would you be able to say, no objections, or not? Sean McDowell and John Stonestreet in their book, Same-Sex Marriage, say it may be that some Christians who share our convictions about God's design for marriage will choose to attend a same-sex ceremony. I know some that have. That is a matter of conscience. Others may choose to avoid the ceremony, but join the reception and bring a gift. So not just total. Others may send a gift, but avoid the ceremony and reception altogether. Whatever we decide, we must act with a clear conscience before God in good faith. It's one of the issues that we need to be talking about and sharing with one another. And how would you respond and why? Well, one of the other questions Paul will get at is, what are you aiming for? A number of people in Corinth were content with asking, well, is it permissible, Paul, or not? And you see, the gospel compels us to aim much higher, Paul says. Not just by asking, can I get away with it? Okay, but is it beneficial? Is it constructive? The first question, is it permissible, only seeks our own good. But the second and the third questions, is it beneficial and constructive? Those seek the good of others, which has been one of Paul's underlying themes through all of this discerning process. And this includes, you know, the impact. Is it beneficial, constructive to young people who will be watching our response and how we respond in different situations, or to new believers who are trying to navigate? So what difference does it make being a Christian now? How do you respond? Well, Paul also, so it's important in the midst of that. And also, Paul also talks about scriptural truths, doctrines, principles. There's some that he's highlighted before, but here in chapter 25, verse 26, he quotes Psalm 24. Psalm 24, for the earth is the Lord's and everything in it. He's saying this underlines the sovereignty of God. God is Lord over all. It's not like some dualism or some competition between, you know, who's the ultimate God. Paul's like, we know there is one God and he has no contenders who come even close. He's not a greenhouse God. He's not the Lord of privatized Canadian spirituality, but he's Lord of the marketplace. And the implication for Paul is that, yes, there are demonic powers at work because there is no neutral ground, but we do not need to live in fear because God is sovereign over all. So it's not based out of fear. It's about of participation. Are we really wanting to affirm and participate with those elements that are actually against God? And I think C.S. Lewis, you know, his simple summary regarding the demonic, I think he was surely right when he said there are two equal and opposite errors into which our race can fall. One is to disbelieve in the existence of the demonic. The other is to believe and to feel an excessive and unhealthy interest in them. They themselves, he concludes, are equally pleased by both errors and hail a materialist or a magician with the same delight. And I think he's very correct on that, reflecting on the Bible. I think an application of this, the earth is the Lord's and everything in it. When I was studying in university, one of the professors especially had one of his lines that he gave to his students right off the bat. He says, I want you to remember that all truth is God's truth. Okay, and I think he's reflected. You know, Paul on Mars Hill, he quotes a pagan philosopher. He doesn't say, I believe everything the pagan philosopher believes. But he said, on this matter, that truth is true. That's true. All truth is God's truth, wherever you may find it, okay, in the midst of that, and to keep that in mind. So that was an application that was, I found, very helpful in my studies and over the years. Paul also points out the importance of when you come to case by case, you're getting down to case by case examples, as he does with them, you're invited to dinner out, okay? He says there's this combination of freedom. He doesn't give that away. We have tremendous freedom, including, he will say, freedom from the judgment of others. Like, we can't just live our lives on whether my mom thinks it's right or not, okay? You know, or whatever it may be for you. It's important, but it's not the ultimate standard. And this combination of freedom and responsibility, because our actions affect others. We have influence for good or bad. Our actions are influential. Our non-actions sometimes are influential, positively or negatively on others. And Paul's point, you know, aim for the glory of God. Aim for the good of others and the glory of God, and that will help getting you going in the right direction. And I want to conclude with a recent case, a question that someone raised for me. We've got, we live, as you know, in a very multicultural setting. And especially when we have people from different religious backgrounds come. And so in this case, Muslim employees. And a Muslim employee requests religious accommodation at work. You see, Muslims pray 5 times a day at prescribed times. And those times, though, are based upon the sun's position. Okay, so they actually shift a little bit each day. And therefore, where you are geographically with the sun, so it's not like 3 o'clock every day. And depends on... Needless to say, this can pose challenges for Muslim workers and for their employers, right? So while we had a meeting arranged for 2:30 and now we have to cut out so that you can go and pray and come back or whatever it may be, or assembly line. Now there are legal issues involved, and I'm not a legal expert, but basically is there reasonable accommodation? We hope there is for our faith, and it reflects often for others as well. And there's legal issues, there's practical issues. Like, is there time and space for prayer? And in the Muslim, for example, there's pre-washing rituals of hand and arms and feet, as well as there's the potential impact on others. It could be for Christians, I don't want to work on Sundays, but it's okay if everybody else does, and then can you adjust my schedule? So it's a challenge this way as well. Adjusting schedules, changing meeting times, if your shifts are... you know, et cetera. So there's practical issues involved, and I think we need to reflect on each of those. But the question also is there the religious issues? Like, would granting someone's religious accommodation request conflict with my own religious convictions? When does reasonable accommodation become a form of affirmation or participation in what they're doing? Now, I think a Muslim praying to Allah is okay, a principle. But I would question more is... if the person is saying, I need to bring my idol in with me to work and have a little shrine place designated so that I can pray, and it's my family business, and people would be coming into the office and seeing, that would be a different issue. Needless to say, these are the kinds of issues that we need, just not to go for an expert for, but that we need to be talking about, and what are the issues that are raised in our culture. And just as the Corinthians, they were working through this, right? And they had been experimenting with different things. And Paul is saying, you know what? Some of those experiments, those are wrong. No way. Some of those you're having qualms over and it's like, not a problem at all. And then there's some in the middle. Think about the good of others and the glory of God in the midst of it. Because if we have no association with people, if we just make our boundaries and limits, you know, we have really high walls and we're going to have no influence, right? But as Christians, we are called to be, Jesus said, salt and light. Those are pretty influential. And we can only do so as we have opportunities to associate and interact with all kinds of people. Some associations and interactions will need to be off limits because they're in opposition to our own commitments as followers of Christ. You know, participating in pagan forms of worship, going to some things are going to be permissible. For example, you know, we had former neighbors and they were Sikh and they invited us to join them at the Sikh temple, right? And we went and participated with them in terms of going to the Sikh temple, observing, asking questions, having a meal afterwards. Some things, though, is it beneficial? Is it constructive? I'm going to close with an example from my dad. My dad, I grew up on a family farm, and we were in the cattle business. And by the cattle business, I mean breeding stock, which meant he traveled all over Canada and North America looking for cattle, selling cattle, and going to lots of fairs, like the PNE would be one of them, okay? And there was kind of there was a rule. That is, the winner at the cattle show buys the drinks, okay, for the other 4 guys afterwards. Permissible? Maybe. But is that beneficial and constructive? And I know I was the youngest, so a whole bunch of the wrestling I heard afterwards, I knew what my plan that my dad had adopted after having wrestled with that. And done some experiments. And his plan was, okay, the winner buys. I don't want to be a party pooper. The winner buys, but the winner is going to buy pizza and non-alcoholic drinks. Okay, so he's not going to buy drinks, just he's going to provide a meal and as much as they want to eat for pizza. So it was always a pizza party afterwards if we won the show. Because he wanted to try to give a positive alternative and witness, to still have association without endorsing some of the things that had very negative impacts in people's lives. So that's, I think, I want to end with a quote from Craig Bloomberg in his commentary. He says, "In general, educating children and adults to responsible behavior and moderation in morally neutral matters proves much more successful than absolute prohibitions or indulgent permissiveness in producing mature Christians." I resonate that. I think I was able to glean a lot of wisdom from how my parents were trying to navigate that. May God help us to be able to say, as Paul did, I'm seeking not my own good, but the good of many, so that they may be saved. And oh, that we could say, follow my example as I follow the example of Christ. Amen. Just taking a moment to reflect back an observation and a question. So if during the meal you are told this food has been offered to idols, so are you then required to stop? And if so, wouldn't that sort of look rather condemning of your host and in turn alienate that person, possibly undoing all of the work you did to get invited to his table in the first place? Too loud. And I think that's a good observation to help me to correct one element in, I think, Paul's recommendation is that the person is probably saying, oh, and by the way, this has been offered to an idol. They may be, in fact, expressing wanting to be sensitive to that you may find that unacceptable, knowing that you're a Christian. So it gave me an opportunity to collaborate or to correct maybe or fill in that one a little bit. And another one, I'd go to a gay wedding, but only after I would have visited with the couple, expressed my position on the situation, and then would have concluded that the discussion with, but I love you as God does, and this trumps my theological understanding on this subject, and oh yes, will there be egg salad sandwiches? I think it's a good response that there is relationship and interaction and that our only statement is not on what we do, whether we participate or not, but that it's in the context of a conversation and an ongoing conversation. And I think that is a good call. It's not saying one, just sometimes there's middle ground in the illustration given, for example, that maybe it's saying, you know what, love you guys, you know, as friends, based on my convictions, this is why I can't participate in the ceremony, but I'd love to come for the reception or whatever that may be. And I think that we need to be interacting and learning with one another. And what is Scripture? How does that guide and direct us in that? So thank you for talk back. Yes, we have a closing song, please. Thanks.
Wasn't sure how many questions you guys were going to send. You only sent 2 comments, so that's good. I know, he got off easy this week. One of the scripture verses in the passage was talking about how there is one body, and so one bread and one wine, and how this song talks about how there is one body, one spirit, one Lord, one faith. There's only one that can wash away our sin, but that we together are also one body, working together in love and in unity. So we're going to close the song singing about that.